many of the books that have your name on them are books that you've edited, work by other people.
Yeah.
To Mend the World, Women Reflect on 9/11, These Are Not Sweet Girls, Poetry by Latin American Women, and several more. How's that work for you? Why do you do that?
Yeah. Because no one else is willing to do the most ungrateful work, which is to edit anthologies and to give notoriety to other people. I've done it out of my commitment to human rights and activism and to the question about women, that I don't want women to be invisible. And as you know, White Pine has published them because the big publishing world of the United States and New York world only takes well-known writers because they want to sell, and rightly so, and these women are not well-known here. So this is part of my, it was, because I cannot do it anymore. It brought a tremendous exhaustion to gather the material. You know, the whole operation, as I'm sure you know, to do this is exhausting. But I did it, and I'm so glad I've done it, because I'm still the only one that has done it. It's tremendous work, and it's a work for others. But I also wanted to create communities of writers so that communities of readers would know them. And in the field of Jewish literature, Latin American Jewish literature, with all humbleness, everything I've done is the only thing there is. Especially in women. In men, there are others. Certainly. But for women, just my own work.
So, given an audience, I guess.
Yeah, an audience.
In places that they wouldn't normally have an audience.
In English, because if they may have a small audience in Latin America, but they had no audience here.
And I imagine their stories are ones that we need to hear.
Absolutely. To Mend the World is the only book that gives voice to the immigrant experience. And there were few books mentioned in the New York Times that appeared on this topic and the first year of the anniversary, and the reviewer only said that the title was too religious. You'll find it's a review on the Times. And I thought, you know, what a pathetic creature this guy is. I don't know who he is. But just to comment on a title, when the whole thing about the book was the voices that have not been heard.
Along those lines, the voices that have not been heard, it's been said that you're preoccupied with memory. What role do you think literature has in the preserving of memory? Or why, I guess?
Yeah, well, why? Literature is the only way to preserve memory. I mean, it's like the queen, the king of the preservation of memory. You look at monuments. You know, I just saw the monument of Lee. You look at the monument of Saddam Hussein, it's gone. A lot of historical monuments are going to be vanished according to wars, earthquakes. The only thing that remains are words. I am quite informed by Jewish tradition because, not only because I was born a Jew and I am a Jew, but I just find it has some remarkable wisdoms. And I think that the bearings of the Torahs when people were escaping, and to kind of think that even now in Europe you find these sacred texts, is a way to preserve the literature of memory. And I think that how can you preserve the experience of torture only through words? It's impossible. You cannot document it through a film. You cannot document it through a recording. It's the human voice through words. And if we don't record this through language, I feel memory vanishes. It's like almost what you don't, who said that, Virginia Woolf or something, what you don't put down doesn't exist. And that's has been my preoccupation, my obsession really.
In that effort, however, you're not a journalist, you're an artist.
Yes.
And so I wondered if you would comment on the role that And it must be a complex one when you're writing a literature of witness, as you are. What role does imagination play in that effort?
It's a great question, and you know there's so much debate about what, especially with Holocaust texts, or even with the controversy of Rigoberta Menchú that wrote about the testimony, what is real, what is imagined. And yes, writers, fortunately we are not journalists, although they're wonderful journalists that are wonderful writers, imagination does play a tremendous role. But memory is also about imagination, because no account told by anyone will be the same. And maybe you interview a survivor from Auschwitz or a survivor from Pinochet, and you interview them in the 80s, and they may respond in one way, and the 2000s will respond in a different way to the same event. Because memory is ambiguous, and it's not static. There's a fluidity to it. But the other thing that I think is quite clear is that writers do not have to be fixated with factual truth. That's the role for journalism and for history. But we also know that history is also a humanist discipline. So imagination is important in memory. And when I wrote Across a Star, it's about my mother. But there's a tremendous amount of it that is quite imaginative. And people say, why did you say this that wasn't true? And why did you create this character? And they don't understand that it's fiction.
I think one of the more interesting moments when you revealed that about your writing was when you talked about how, in some cases, dreams are the places where the dead can meet again with us, and dreams can cause the resurrection of memories to which we might not have any other access.
Yes, yes. And I think that memory is also about giving a space to the dead, allowing for the voices of so many people that have been submerged to be, like you said, resurrected. And I think that when I say dream also, is almost a symbol or a metaphor for a place that is also ambiguous, because the dream world is by nature ambiguous. It's evocation. It's almost in the zone of remembering and not remembering, because you can never quite remember the dream.
Yes. Yeah. Memory and the absence of it is something that we've touched on a little bit with relation to the United States. One of the things that I find myself often talking about in trying to explain America to friends from Europe and other countries, South America, is that it's a country that has a tremendous innocence, and it's actually then ultimately a kind of dangerous innocence. During Pinochet's brutal dictatorship in Chile, which drove your family into exile here in the U.S., you've suggested in some of your writings that fear motivated many people to keep silent or to ignore gross violations of human rights, and it strikes me that fear is part of our contemporary atmosphere in the United States, and that it is potentially creating another form of undermining human rights or a sense of social responsibility. And I wonder if you would care to comment on the current situation with Pinochet slithering out of his responsibilities, and also perhaps things that are going on here in the United States.
Yeah. A few things to this question, many things to this question. Your first question about the innocence of America, I think that yes, the innocence of America has allowed this country to dream, to be daring, to be creative, to make it a dream for immigrants. And it is still a country of immigrants, even if they are, you know, closing every single possible border. But when this innocence becomes an excuse for ignorance and for not knowing what we Americans have done, it becomes extremely dangerous. it becomes the ignorance of the fool, the innocence of the fool. I think that you can have innocence, but at the same time understand what is just. And I think the 9/11 attack on this country was not so much the death of innocent, was the fact that America is no longer protected from the dangers of the world, and that America will join the suffering of the world. And then another parallel with 9/11 is that when 9/11 was taking place in the US, few journalists, except people like Ariel Dorfman, few of them mentioned that there was another 9/11 that took place in Chile, created by the terrorism that the United States government, in a way, was supporting, so the CIA. So it was a time where you could see how one particular nation was completely ignored, and how this nation created a whole mythology based on 9/11. I honor each one of the 3,000 people that died in the Trade Center and everywhere. But if you think of all the millions of people that have died in wars elsewhere, we are still very blessed. And I don't think retaliation to Afghanistan or Iraq was the answer. Now, the question about fear, and this is my own personal thought, which I truly support and believe in, this country is having very similar patterns of dictatorial regimes. And I feel somehow I am like in a little dictatorship here, under disguise of this democracy. And George Bush has created the ideology of fear, and saying, if you do not vote for me, you will not be protected. And I think there's paranoia, the levels of alert, and that's exactly what General Pinochet did. Now, Dorfman wrote a wonderful editorial in the New York Times and op-ed about 2 or 3 days ago, and he said that Pinochet's dirty dealings with his money were found because through the Patriot Act they discovered that he had money in the Riggs Bank, and he became like a terrorist that stole $8 million. But he also says that it was the same secrecy that Pinochet governed that allowed him to steal the money. So secrecy is dangerous no matter how you look at it. And he was talking the secrecy of the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is just a disgrace to American faith in the world. And I am very frightened for this country. I have been through a dictatorship. And I think we've all complied to so many things. And what is really scaring me is this whole defeatist attitude that there's nothing that can be done. And I think that's wrong. There's much that can be done.
One of the things that you have taken on is a concept that, and I think it's actually another form of contemporary dangerous innocence, is the concept of multiculturalism. You've insisted that you are not yourself multicultural.
No.
You're, maybe the correct word would be intercultural. Is that a better word? Or?
Yeah. I think that, for example, the very controversial writings of Ilan Stavans, do you know the critic Ilan Stavans, the whole idea about the bilingual Spanglish? He believes there is such a language as Spanglish. I have trouble believing that. I think there is either Spanish and there is English. We may mix some words, but I don't think Spanglish is a language. Multiculturalism as an ideology has been a possibility for maybe creating diversity, but I think it has become a very intolerant concept. And I think it's been a really appropriated by people from the left that have very fundamentalist views of the world, just like people from the right. And I consider that absolutely dangerous. And you know, I am a person of the left, but I cannot support Castro. It's just, I cannot believe that that Cuba is a democracy, and it's just very frightening how Castro is constantly praised and Chavez is considered to be a manipulation from the right, and that's why he's not allowed to govern. I mean, I have problems with that. There's so many problems about, like, what is Latino literature in English? Is it the English literature written in English by Latino immigrants? Where do you divide the lines? Where's the heritage of the past? So all of this multicultural world is very complex to me, and the fact is that still this is a monolingual society. I think that even more intercultural is the idea that we'll talk about today. Is I like to believe that I'm a person that crosses borders, that I am in the thresholds of places, but I am also rooted in the Spanish world and in the Jewish world. Those are the anchor of my world, those two worlds. And then that's where I speak from. You have to have a platform where you can speak from. It's like you cannot be all over the place. And I think multiculturalism is like being all over the place.
Is part of the problem with multiculturalism that with the two languages, or inherent in the two languages, is a different way of experiencing the world? Do the languages reflect that? When you're thinking in Spanish, are you seeing the world different from when
absolutely.
You're thinking in English?
That's why I don't believe there's one language called Spanglish. Mm-hmm. When you're thinking in Spanish, the world is different. Even, you know, when Spanish speakers are talking to one another, even their physical proximity is different than when you're speaking in English. It's a whole way of decoding and coding the world. So language is identity.
Something remarkable in your work and the work of many Jewish writers, but particularly in your work, you don't just have that portable identity that comes through having Spanish as a spiritual home, but you also have that particular identity that comes from having Judaism as a spiritual home.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you comment on how you think that has affected your understanding of your own family history and also your current experiences.
Yeah. I come from a non-traditionally religious family, but a profoundly Jewish family. And I think that if you understand the Jewish world, you will see that it's not a contradiction. In the sense that you can be a Jew so rooted in your history and in your values, that in a way God becomes secondary. And I think that's an amazing thing that Jews have been able to say. But what has linked my Judaism to my experience as a writer are two fundamental things. I think that Judaism has always understood the world from an ethical point of view. And I'm not talking about contemporary Israel or politics, but I'm talking about the Ten Commandments and the necessity, this old Talmudic concept where the title of the book comes from, to mend the world, to create justice. If you save one life, you save the world. It's basically saying if you are a decent human being, you are really doing decent things in the world. So the ethics of Judaism and the struggles for social justice have been what I have wanted to take from that Judaism. Also, and I think David Grossman has said it beautifully, he says that all writers are Jewish. And I think in a way it's true, because the whole idea of the Torah and the whole idea of biblical interpretation is about decoding and coding the world. And I think that anybody who is in the writing business decodes and codes the world. And I also think that I don't by any ways believe that we are the chosen people, but what is so amazing is how we have blossomed in the diaspora, and that we are still here as a people in spite of, you know, centuries of discrimination and genocide, even from the expulsion of Spain or even before the destruction of the Second Temple. And I think what has kept the Jews together is the idea of home and the idea of memory, which is the ideas that I write about. Home as an inner center and memory as giving voice to the invisible and becoming a witness.